The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Before any of it, we will kick things off as we do every day at 4 o'clock with our afternoon update, catching you up on all that has happened. Kieran Cunningham is with me, chief sports writer with the Irish Daily Star, and Wendy Grace, the broadcaster and columnist. You're both very welcome, folks. Leo's last day today, Wendy, I think his last official function, this North-South Ministerial Council meeting that happened this morning. In about 2 hours' time, he officially takes the trip to the Oras to resign. And then by this time tomorrow, we will have a new Taoiseach in Simon Harris. If we focus on Leo Varadkar for a moment, I mean, now that the dust has settled, as it were, since he announced that to the shock of many people, including his closest colleagues a couple of weeks ago, are we any clearer as to defining what his legacy is as Taoiseach? Or is that something that can only becomes clear over a longer period of time?
Well, I think one of the first things, obviously, that he'll always be remembered for is being the first gay mixed race leader of the country. And obviously that was one of the things that was most talked about at the time. I think what's a real positive is those two things now don't make a difference. In other words, it doesn't matter what our leader's sexuality or colour of their skin is. What matters is their leadership skills. I do think, though, those two things provided him a lot of political cover for a number of years, and then that kind of faded away. And since 2020, obviously, we've seen his popularity just continuously decline alongside with the party. But I think what's interesting is probably a lot of younger people thought this guy at the time was the youngest Taoiseach, 37 at the time, thinking, OK, what's he going to do for the next generation, for younger people? But now those who are in their 20s and 30s are going to be worse off than their parents, you know, in terms of owning a house, in terms of their general economic outlook on life. So that, to me, is one of the worst things of his legacy that he's going to be remembered for. Obviously, you know, the housing crisis has gotten worse and worse with him at the helm. The homelessness crisis has, you know, the biggest numbers ever recorded, especially the number of homeless children in their thousands. And, you know, I don't think he ever shook the Leo the Leek title, you know, that kind of stuck with him. And he was often kind of remembered for a lot of his political gaffes. I can't get that image of him out of my head, you know, saying he felt like he was in Love Actually when he was in Downing Street.
I'd forgotten that? About that.
And showing off his socks with Justin Trudeau, going for runs with him. There was a lot of that kind of stuff. But, you know, I think towards the end of his tenure, one of the things was that he just lacked energy. It felt like he just kind of given up, accepted his demise. And obviously that was recognisable in his resignation speech when he did seem kind of beaten down and clearly emotional.
Kieran Cunningham, you're going to have to say something to defend the stellar legacy of Leo Varadkar.
Yeah,
it's a difficult task. Is
there's a lot in there. He's an unusual Irish politician, I think, in that he's an ideological politician. Like Fianna Fáil politicians, for example, have never had any ideology rather than being in power. But I think he's very much in the Leo Varadkar was in the conservative in the Tory party sense, of somebody who believed in monetarism and neoliberalism and the Milton Friedman school of Keynesian economics. And he found it very hard, I think, to relate to people who didn't have his worldview. I think that, you know, if you talk with Infingale, the things they talk of his legacy, they talk of things like Brexit. But, you know, that came up at the last election. People didn't care about Brexit. You know, that gets you pats on the back in Brussels. It did matter, but it doesn't really get people engaged. And the other thing was the what they see as leadership through COVID. But that was quite divisive. You know, there were decisions made that people still disagree with. You know, there's something I would give him credit for. And it's a symbolic thing and it's a small thing. And I know a lot of people say it doesn't matter. But he learned Irish while he was Taoiseach. You know, he didn't. And he took classes both in Dublin and then he went to the Iddiscale School in Donegal. And I think little things like that are of symbolic importance if you're the leader of the government. You know, Mary McLeish actually did the same and went to the same place. And I think for somebody, he didn't have to do that. And nobody within Fine Gael certainly would have criticised him for not being fluent in Irish. But I think that stands to him. I am glad that there's no grandstanding from him on the way out, like Charlie Haughey when he was called in Shakespeare.
I've done the state some service.
Yeah, I've done the state some service, no more of that from The Merchant of Venice. But thankfully, Leo has spared us that.
Othello.
Othello, sorry. Oh,
I know, but listen, I hate to correct someone's Shakespearean quotes.
It'll be interesting to see, because obviously he said, yeah, no, I'm sticking around, but it'd be interesting to see if that actually happens. I mean, with the kind of 200,000 or so golden parachute on the horizon, but, so what
the,
would you do?
The Brexit thing, though, and I understand the point you make, people are kind of at the ballot box are not going to make a decision based on that, but is that the type of thing, Kieran, that over time he gets more credit for? Maybe how he managed the relationship with Boris Johnson, that meeting that he had with him, that one-on-one meeting that I think was kind of, many raised eyebrows in Brussels about it. Kind of, what is the Irish Prime Minister, as they might have described him, doing, going off having this kind of bilateral away from the negotiating table? But it proved to be fruitful.
Yeah, but to be honest, it reminds me of a story around Nixon's trip to China. When he was talking to a Chinese official and he asked him, what do you think of the French Revolution? And the Chinese officials are just too early to tell. So I think maybe we'll wait a while and see how the Brexit thing pans out. Was it really a success?
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. So I guess then the attention moves, Wendy, to Simon Harris and big speech at the weekend. He's going to build 250,000 houses.
No evidence to support that statement?
Yeah, well, I mean, himself and others within Fine Gael were very quick to criticise Ivana Bacic and Holly Cairns and others at their own party conferences, having made similar claims about the extraordinary number of houses they're going to build. Kind of an indictment. I'd wonder how people within Fianna Fáil, particularly Dara O'Brien, might have looked at that.
Well, I think
a repudiation of the Housing for All plan, is it?
And also, it's just when you look at kind of Ardesh speech as a whole, it just feels like, I think how a lot of us feel when it comes to politics is a lot of promises that may turn out to be empty. And, you know, you can make a statement, but you have to clarify how you're going to actually achieve it. And I don't think that that's clear at this particular point. And as well, the trust is broken. I think there's a lack of trust, particularly in Fine Gael. I was reflecting on, was it back in 2016 when they said, we're going to abolish USC? And there was pictures of Leo, who we were just talking about, standing beside posters saying the same thing. That hasn't happened. Like, there's a list of so many things that you can point to that haven't happened, that promises have been made. How are we going to, I mean, he's got a few months to prove himself and in terms of before the next general election. And it's easy to make statements, but the proof will be in what he actually achieves.
I was struck here in listening to that speech at the weekend, the promise of 250,000 houses, about how different Leo Varadkar was as Taoiseach compared to as a minister. He had this reputation of kind of shooting from the hip, telling it like it is, however you want to describe it. And he realised as Taoiseach he couldn't necessarily behave that way. And I wonder, has Simon Harris learned it yet? Like a promise like that, without any consultation with his colleagues in government, I'm not sure how wise it is. It reminded me a little bit of an immediate repeat cervical smears for every woman in the country in the face of kind of cervical crisis. And in the wake of kind of pressure because of a primetime special, no child will wait longer than 4 months for spinal surgery in our children's hospitals. Kind of promises made without ever, it appears, consulting anybody to find out if they were even possible to back them up.
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely a reaction in that it's the biggest issue out there. That's the one that's brought up by most people, and was the main reason why Sinn Féin had a significant surge in support. And I think there's probably a recognition as well that they're going to be, I think Fine Gael will be hit really hard in the local and European elections. I think there will be. And for the general election, they're losing so many, such a high percentage of sitting TDs. Like, they could be going back into that general election as sitting ducks. So I think throwing that out there, but it's all very good promising it. But, you know, they haven't been in opposition for the last decade or so. You know, they've been in power. They've had the chance to do this and haven't. So I think people are very sceptical of such promises now.
You expose yourself to criticism when you... It's like correcting someone's grammar when you tell them that they've quoted the wrong Shakespearean play. Mike Ryan in Dublin 18 says, nobody likes a smart arse, Kieran. And by the way, so that's me, I think, rather than you, Kieran Cunningham. Nobody likes a smart arse, Kieran. And Radker's achievements exceed most people his age, including your own. So a little humanity and respect would do you well. says Mike. Mike, thanks for the advice. 087 1400 106. Can I ask you instead about a leader or a former leader and a man who hopes to be a leader again on the other side of the world in the States? So Donald Trump, he has taken to his own platform today, Truth Social, his own network, to talk about abortion rights. What has he said, Wendy, and why might some abortion campaigner or anti-abortion campaigners be disappointed in it?
So prior to this, because of the overturning of Roe versus Wade, so this basically meant that each state, the overturning of this law, each state then would decide how they would legislate for abortion. So he's basically just repeated what that overturning meant. He said that each state should be allowed to decide. I think those who are kind of ardent pro-lifers would have rather he said, no, we should just have a blanket ban on abortion.
Well, that's what they were but that's what they were hoping for, some of them, wasn't it? A national policy.
I think his message is this. It's, you know, I was president when Roe versus Wade was overturned. I did that. So now it's up to you to win the hearts and minds and put forward your case in each individual state. What we're going to see happening is obviously different decisions being made in different states. Now, if you think Ireland is polarised on that issue, the states is on a whole other level. And the sad consequence of that is it doesn't allow room for proper kind of reflection and discussion and kind of going, well, whatever you feel on the issue, you know, 64 million abortions, that's 12 times our population, you know, since abortion was introduced. Do we want to reflect on that? Do we want to reflect on the fact that in New York, more black babies are aborted than are born? You know, some of these things that we've seen unrail themselves over the last number of years. And again, that's not to say I'm pro-life, I'm pro-choice. It's just there's no room allowed for an actual reflective discussion on it. What is interesting, recently Ohio legislated in their constitution for abortion, but hundreds of millions was put into kind of promoting that campaign. So you have this happening at the one hand, it kind of taking up so much discussion in advance of this election, where it's probably actually, for most people, it's not the kind of core issue that they're worried about when they're voting for the next president. And we're not talking about, you know, practical things. Like, America is one of the only developed countries in the world that doesn't have paid maternity or paternity leave. You know, so we're not talking about those things. But I think that it's probably a smart political move, because if it's, when you're thinking of, say, his pro-life base, they'd nowhere else to go, because Joe Biden would be kind of seen as one of the most extreme pro-abortion presidents in history. And even some Democrats would say he's kind of gone too far to the left and he's isolated a lot of, say, the Latin American vote for him. So it'll be interesting to see how all of that plays out politically.
It lends itself, though, as well, doesn't it? Quite apart from the actual issue, Kieran, to this sense in the States that there is a growing division between people, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's been obvious for decades.
Blue states getting bluer and red states getting redder.
Without a doubt. And I think this will be a particularly divisive election campaign. And I have read a few pieces over the last few weeks that the two main issues that are going to be fought on are abortion and immigration. And I think that could be a problem for either candidate if they go down that road, because you go back to the famous line of George Bush Sr., is the economy stupid? That's ultimately what people generally vote on. It's not the other issues that people get bogged down. But there is an ideological culture war that's been raging for decades, and abortion has been to the front of that. And I think it will be weaponized by both sides again this year.
Yeah, on our own politics, Darren in Dublin says, more drama about Leo going than you'd find in an episode of EastEnders. I'm glad he's gone, but not totally glad, so says a conflicted Darren. Harris has proven to be the master of empty promises when Minister for Health. Fine Gael or Tory life for me, so no thanks, says somebody else. 087 1400 106. Kieran Cunningham, tell me what is happening at Liverpool. They're going to bring back terraces, is that right?
It's rail seating, it's called, and it's actually been there for a couple of years, but they're bringing in some more before the end of this season. And it's effectively, there's a seat there, but you can flip the seat up and stand when you're celebrating goals or whatever, when they're singing songs. But there's a rail behind you for safety reasons. So,
in other parts of the stadium, the seats don't flip, is it? So they don't lend themselves to people standing.
Yeah, these look more like the temporary seats that you used to get in the old Lansdowne Road. Like, they're not as sturdy as what you would have got, or, you know, as as regulation in terms of seats. But last week I actually interviewed a guy, Adrian Tempany, who's a Hillsborough survivor. And, you know, it's very, it really knocks you back when you hear somebody going through what actually happened there. And like, standing was banned at grounds after that. But ultimately what happened there wasn't because of standing. It was because of terrible policing and terrible organisation. And even though he talked about where he was in Leppins Ling where it all happened. He was in Pen 3. Even the language used, there were fans were basically like treated like animals. And at Hillsborough, they ended up being treated like animals in an abattoir that an area that was supposed to hold, say, 3,000 people, you had 10,000 pushed into it. And that ultimately, and then they wouldn't open the gates when it was seen there was over full. So that was the problem rather than standing. You can have safe standing. And I think there's a move towards that because a lot of people do, like I go to games in different sports and often people are in seats, but they jump up all the time or standing when various things happen and at sporting events. It's a natural reaction. So I think you will see this being gradually phased back in, that there will be a certain percentage of standing.
What the atmosphere at Premier League games. I mean, is it still as good as it once was? Or, you know, there's often criticism of, say, rugby internationals in the Aviva that the atmosphere has been eroded by kind of corporate hospitality and the amount of kind of non-hardcore fans getting their hands on tickets. Do you see that erosion at Premier League games? Or is there still the same kind of raucous atmosphere you might have found 20 years ago?
It depends. Like at times it can be still very strong. But I think what's very telling is if you look at photographs of games now or in the past or even television footage, there were a lot of kids and teenagers at games in the past. Now it's largely middle-aged men. And that comes down to price. Like a lot of people have been priced out of it, particularly young people. Like at Anfield, where a lot of people would say the best atmosphere, they had what was called a boys' pen. So it was everybody was under 16, I think, in there. So loads of kids went. But you don't see many children at Premier League games.
Would it put you up? Go on, Wendy.
Well, the one and only time I was at a Liverpool match was about 20 years ago with my elder brother in the cop stand. And I still remember it to this day. It was absolutely fantastic. It's one of my fondest memories. Yeah, they did. Don't ask me who they were playing against because I texted them. I said, you have to remind me.
I saw Liverpool play Arsenal
in
the old Highbury. And Nicolas Anelka and Michael Owen both played for 90 minutes and it was nil-all. A miserable experience.
I'll
stick to league finals.
I used that because I was only a teenager, you know, and I used that as my kind of cool card for many years after that. I was in the cop at a Liverpool game. But, you know, I think when you think of the event itself, obviously being able to get up to cheer, to be able to do it freely, I think is a really good thing. I don't know, maybe Kieran would know better. It'd be interesting to see, will those tickets become more expensive, the ones that are going to be the ones that you can stand at if you want to?
Yeah, will there be a premium on them?
Well, as far as I know, they're cop tickets, so all the cop tickets are the same, whether you're standing or sitting. So
someone here says, it's in Celtic Park already a few years and the atmosphere is great. Liverpool ripping off Celtic again.
No, it's in many grounds around Europe. But no, it's not. This isn't the first ground to do it. You know, other Premier League grounds have it as well.
I don't think that listener is going to be dissuaded from his argument that Liverpool are ripping off Celtic again by your facts here.
This is another Othello moment.
087-1400-106. Kieran Cunningham, chief sports writer with the Irish Daily Star. Wendy Grace, broadcaster and columnist. Thank you both very much. I hear first the Merchant of Venice, now George Bush. Truth doesn't matter, says one of our listeners. What's the George Bush reference? Who mentioned George Bush?
It's the economy, stupid.
That was Bush.
It was Bush.
Yeah, it was Bush. Yeah, now I'm correcting listeners. That's whatever I'm correcting guests. If I'm correcting listeners who've taken the trouble to text in, I'm in real trouble. Wendy and Kieran, thanks a million for joining me.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.